Dave, and that was Lullaby by Sagala and Paloma Faith. Speaking of faith... Faith No More, one of the greatest bands ever of all time. And there's a new book, and it's a definitive and brilliantly dense, I mean that in a good way, story. The true story of Faith No More. It's called Small Victories. The author is an Irishman, Adrian Hart. Good morning, Adrian.
Hello, Joe. How are you? Very nice segue there.
It was good, right? It was good. Slick, yes. That was good. I'm absolutely delighted to talk to you, and I've been reading the book, and it really is class. And, you know, I mentioned earlier on in the show that you don't have to be a massive fan of Faith No More necessarily, because the story of the band is so remarkable, and it involves so much dysfunction and rows and tension and brilliant music.
Yeah, for me, it tells the story of one of rock's most interesting and entertaining bands. You know, they're a band that managed to be innovative, influential, ever-changing.
Yeah.
But while it's the story of Faith No More, as you said, it's also the story of rock music in the 1980s and the 90s and even now.
So. Yeah. Well, let's start there because bands are often influenced by their environment and where they're from. How relevant was that for Faith No More? They were in San Francisco in the early 80s, and what set them apart from their peers when they first began recording and performing?
Yeah, well, Faith No More, the key to Faith No More, understanding Faith No More, is they rebelled against what they thought they were supposed to be, and they were very much an anti-hippie band. They were very much against the 1960s San Francisco vibe. They emerged in the kind of the post-punk hardcore era, and they also rebelled a little bit about that as well. So, well, you know, bands like Flipper and other quite famous hardcore bands were emerging. They were and playing quite aggressive music. Faith No More were happy to kind of dress up, play incense, and you know, have a keyboardist. Roddy Bottom as one of their, you know, main band members. So they're always pushing back against what their expectations were, and that definitely influenced them. And I think, you know, they came out about in the mid-80s. They were post-punk. Then they became, you know, adopted by the metal community, and then later by alternative rock. So they were kind of adopted by the scenes, but they were never really part of any scene themselves.
Of course, they were separate from it. Let's talk about Chuck Mosley, who was the first permanent singer, the first regular singer with the band, and he was quite an interesting character, very intriguing. His hero was David Bowie, and he sometimes tried to adopt Bowie's vocal style, but because the band had such a varying sound that, and you write about this in the book, he found himself rapping and ranting, as he told it, and that was the origin of rap rock.
Yeah, that's the way he tells it, and I think there's an element of truth to that. He wasn't a very confident singer in the studio. He started out as a keyboard player himself. He kind of volunteered to do it. He was, you know, the band had, you know, seven vocalists around this time, and he was like number six in the full list, and
including, you know, Courtney Love.
Courtney Love was just before him, yeah. And Chuck, you know, he said he didn't sing. He tried to croon like David Bowie, and he didn't really understand the music. So he said that came out like ranting, and then he said it came like kind of proto rapping. And really, he became the first man to kind of rap to kind of, you know, heavy metal and hard rock riffs, and it really invented a kind of rap metal. You know, even before the Red Hot Chili Peppers, before Rage Against the Machine, even around the same time as the Beastie Boys. So he was an innovator, but he was kind of an accidental innovator.
He fell out with the band, or they kind of. It was one of those awkward moments where the band sort of disbanded, but they did that so that he, you know, rather than say you're fired, briefly, why did they fall out before we get to talk about Mike Patton?
They fell out because he wasn't maybe as professional and as focused as the rest of the band, and they wanted to go further in a different direction, and he was liable to fall asleep on stage. What happened is one of their biggest gigs in Los Angeles, and you know, he It was a difficult decision for the band because, you know, he was the face of the band. He was on the front cover of Melody Maker in 1988 when they were quite big in the UK, and they had to really start from scratch afterwards. But it was typical of Faith No More. They knew where they needed to go and had to sacrifice something to go that way, and they were prepared to do that.
Yeah, and in stepped Mike Patton, Adrian. And in the book, Bill Gould, when you were talking to him, he said about Mike Patton, he was like Justin Bieber. He got it musically, but he didn't fit in. But then, as you say, it soon transpired that Mike Patton spoke the same musical language, which is a lovely phrase.
Yeah, and the bands speak a lot about speaking musical language. Drummer Mike Borden speaks about that a lot as well. You know, Patton was an ingenue. He was from a hick town, Eureka, in Northern California. You know, and he was very fresh-faced. There's some photographs in the book showing him, you know, and I was surprised even how young he looked. He was 18, 19. You know, he was coming to the big city. These guys were all in their kind of early to mid-20s. They were a lot older, a lot more experienced. And he was kind of thrown in the deep end. And that's where Bill Gould's Justin Bieber expression came from. But he got it. You know, he did speak the same musical language. He wrote the lyrics. He wrote the melody for the first album in the space of 2 weeks. He said he treated it like a school project. And, you know, he was a effervescent face of the band. And he looked good. He had the moves. He had the sound. So he helped propel them to the big time, to mainstream success.
Absolutely. And his contribution to Epic, you know, was part of the band's worldwide success. It was regarded, though, that song, let's talk about it for a second. It was regarded as radio poison because it was a mixture of rap and metal. But it was in a kind of a roundabout way that that this became their big breakthrough by touring in the UK.
Yeah, then they toured in the UK. They became big. They were always bigger in the UK. They had to start from scratch when Patton left.
Yeah.
And then it was when MTV. It took a year after the release of The Real Thing in 1989. And, you know, Epic didn't become a hit until, you know, mid to late 1990. It took a year. It took badgering of MTV. There's quite a lot of detail in the book about how they approached MTV.
It's a great story, yeah.
They got that iconic video, you know, the flopping fish, the exploding piano. And, you know, that's got them. The image got them as much as anything. The band didn't like the video. Bill Gould especially didn't like the video, but it worked. The combination of the visual and the unique, you know, rap and metal sound worked for them, and it gave them a huge hit.
Mm. Oh, it was. I mean, and it's still, the horns in it just make it something very special, and the sound of it, that's where they got the title, because they were so following this, there was peer endorsement from the likes of Axl Rose and Slash and James Hetfield, and then Angel Dust, which was again, you know, brought them, cemented their position. But even though, again, what we spoke about earlier, fans didn't really expect them to perform some of the songs that they did, it was the epitome of the band that they confounded expectations on Angel Dust.
Yeah, you know, they did it their own way. They wanted to put different influences together. They kept evolving. You know, a lot of bands innovate and achieve success, and then they become their own tribute band. And Faith No More were never going to do that. You know, they were tagged as funk metal. They hated that. So Angel Dust was a reaction against the success of Epic and The Real Thing. And it was also, it's just a natural progression for the band. They were always going to go in that direction.
Yeah.
You know, and as Bill Gould said, you know, we went against our own interests sometimes to go where the music was taking us. And that cost them.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in the book and there's so much in the story. We could talk for hours on it. And, you know, you've got as much detail in the rest of Faith No More's discography. I was quite surprised when Sol Invictus come along. I didn't actually expect to hear anything from them at all. There's a great line, Adrian, about their importance. Nirvana may have killed off hair metal and mainstream rock with Nevermind, but Faith No More had already inflicted mortal wounds with The Real Thing. I mean, that's not overstating.
No, I think that's true. You know, I don't think Faith No More really influenced Nirvana, you know, sonically and musically, but, you know, they paved the way. You know, Chris Novoselic, he's quoted in the book as saying that Nirvana, or that Faith No More and Jane's Addiction paved the way for Faith No More. So, you know, they made alternative music, you know, popular. The MTV were willing to play it, and then came, you know, Nirvana, then came grunge, and even after that, then came the likes of, you know, Korn, Limp Bizkit, the new metal, which, you know, Faith No More inadvertently spawned more musically as well after that.
Yeah, well, you say before new metal was new, it was Faith No More, so we can't really blame them for Fred Durst, though, can we, Adrian?
No. I think there was a quote one time, maybe Tony Benn, the Labour MP, said it about you can't blame Labour, you can't blame Karl Marx for the excesses of communism and Stalin. You can't blame, just as you can't blame, you know, Jesus for what's been done wrong in his name, and you can't blame Faith No More for new metal.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. But their legacy and influence is far and wide, and it's very well documented. It's superbly documented in the book Small Victories, The True Story of Faith No More. Adrian, like I said, we could talk for ages, but I cannot recommend the book enough to listeners who are fans of metal, fans of music, and just fans of a great story.
Thank you very much, Joe. You know, there's a lot for non-Faith No More fans. There's a lot of Metallica in there, there's a lot of Guns N' Roses, there's a lot of Soundgarden, a lot of Queens of Stone Age.
Yeah.
You know, there's even Charles and Eddie and Milli Vanilli.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's
class.
It's for everyone.
It's for everyone. Adrian, thank you so much. Have a good day.
Thank you very much, Joe. Thank
no
you.
Problem.
Bye.
You're very welcome. Adrian Hart, the author of the book. Absolutely recommend it if you're into music. It's a home dinger. This is Faith No More with Easy. It's Today FM.